Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour for January 12th, 2023, second show of the big coming year 2023. I think it's going to be a good year. And this is from a listener, this first topic, writing in asking about the Apophis asteroid. Now, you may have heard about this, that allegedly in the year 2029, which is only 6 years away, in April of that year, allegedly, an asteroid is supposed to come within 30,000 kilometers of Earth. So that's pretty close. That would be a couple Earth radii away, and it's about 300 meters across. So it's not one of these things that is going to wipe out the dinosaurs or the human race, whatever. Most of these impacts, if something did impact Earth, would be absorbed locally, although you wouldn't want to be there if this thing hit. But allegedly it's not going to hit Earth, and allegedly NASA has good enough data to make this estimate that it's not going to be near, not going to actually hit Earth. But that's pretty close by anybody's standard. So whether this one is coming close or not, it's a wake-up call. We have to start doing something about these things. Now, NASA just had a mission. It was called the DART mission, where they collided a spacecraft, this little teeny spacecraft about the size of a refrigerator, into an asteroid that was orbiting another asteroid. And so this was, they were able to measure the change in the orbital velocity, and so they could determine the amount of impact in its orbit that this impactor had to change the momentum, the energy, etc., of this asteroid that they hit. Now, this, just to be clear, was not the Apophis asteroid. It was a different one. It was a totally different experiment. But it's not going to cut the mustard. That is not a technique that should be used or should even be considered to be used. Because if we're dealing with asteroids that are big enough to, say, wipe out the human race or something, they're going to be pretty big. And anything we can build and get up into outer space is not going to be big enough to alter the course of an asteroid. So we have to find some other method, and I do have a method. I'll be talking about that here. And the way this came to me was in an email from a listener, as I say, and something else that's going around, so I'll do a little segue here. Somebody's claiming and writing to everybody that the value of pi is wrong, and that when NASA made its calculations, that the calculations were wrong, and therefore the estimate of 30,000 miles away from Earth might be wrong, and therefore it might hit Earth, or might not, might be farther away, nobody knows, based on some other value of pi. Pi being that's the Greek letter that represents the ratio between the circumference of a circle and the diameter of a circle. And so, anyway, let me give the true value of pi on the air. It's 3.1415926536, and it continues on. There's an infinite number of digits in the number pi, but it's not this other number that people are trying to present. And this is very easy to prove algebraically. In fact, the ancients, I showed a method a number of weeks ago, months ago maybe, dealing with how the ancients actually calculated pi. It's very easy. You take a circle and you divide it into linear pieces. In other words, you could start with a square. It's a four-sided, in a sense, a four-sided circle that wouldn't roll very good if it were a tire. And then take a six-sided figure where the edges of this approximation of a circle touch the circle, and then go and make it into eight pieces, and then you can double it each time, so it'd be 16, 32 pieces. And so these pieces are like little lines that approximate the circle. And so what you're doing is you're dividing the circle into little triangles, with the outside part of the triangle being the line, the segment that approximates the circle. And within a very short time, you get a very, very exact value for pi. And now you can do this two ways. You can go outside the circle with your lines, or you can go inside the circle, and that gives you an upper limit and a lower limit. And as these come together, they kind of squeeze together, and the value of pi is between them. But anyway, very, very simple algebraic, geometric calculations give you this number pi, like I read off, 3.14159265336. And that you can very easily calculate this number, as did the ancients. So people going around and claiming that there's a, you know, the value of pi is wrong, it's just goofiness. And you can show this yourself. It's not, you don't have to believe me because I'm a mathematician or whatever. Okay, so anyway, back to the Apophis asteroid. How would you get rid of this? And by the way, interestingly enough, in the news, there's a lot of people saying that there was a mass extinction of man himself around 12,000 BC when allegedly a comet hit Earth and caused what they call the Younger Dryas period. And there's really, in spite of the fact that people have a lot of data about archaeology and criticizing standard archaeology, which it should be. It should be criticized. But then they come up with this alternative date of 12,000 BC. And we know for a fact that there were disasters from celestial events within the last 10,000 years. One as recent as around 1500 BC is the estimated time frame. And I personally don't put dates on things. I look at what other people do in terms of dating, in terms of calendars. And the best ones I can determine so far deal with that date of around 1500 BC, when Moses was coming out of Egypt with the Israelites, when the Mayans, the precursors of the modern Mayas, were in the southeastern region of Mexico, and also the Peruvian, the ancestors of the Incas, were building their cities, etc., in Peru. And all of this came to a screeching halt, and it was due to celestial events. But there were celestial events where a large comet came by Earth and did a lot of damage. It didn't hit Earth, it came by, and that's typically what happens. And so the Noah's Flood, for example, we flew through a comet tail for 40 days and 40 nights, and there was a torrential rain, literally, for 40 days and 40 nights. And what's very interesting about the Noah's Flood and building the ark and putting all the animals in it to save the animals and the plants was that Noah had forewarning that this was going to happen. And this, by modern astronomical standards, would have taken quite a bit of precision. So whoever warned Noah really had a lot more information than we have today, because comets change their orbits, especially big comets, the kind that we're talking about for the Noah's Flood. Okay, so anyway, back to the Apophis asteroid or other asteroids that might be coming close to Earth in the future. What do we do with these things? And I do have a plan, and here's how it works. An asteroid is made up, let's just assume it's made up of rock. It probably has metal content in it. It has solidified chemicals. When they landed on the surface of a comet recently, it had organic molecules. They were basically crystalline or amorphous forms of organic sand. Let's just put it that way. There was no ice or water or snow, even though it was a comet, definitely an active comet that they landed on the nucleus. But at any rate, so it's material. So how would you basically disintegrate this? And it's actually very simple. You put a large reflector, actually you put it on, and it would look like a parachute. And it would be held away from the sun by solar wind pressure. And basically, it would be a reflective material that would be focused on the asteroid itself. And what would happen is it would simply disintegrate the asteroid over a period of time, and it wouldn't take long. If you took, let me use an example. Say you went out into your backyard and you took a magnifying glass. Let's say one that was about 6 inches in diameter. Let's get a fairly decent sized one. Or no, let's take a foot in diameter lens, a magnifying glass. And it's a nice sunny day, so you go out in the backyard and you take your foot in diameter magnifying glass and you focus the sun on the ground. It would literally, in seconds, it would vaporize anything that it touched. And so it's the same principle. So you would take this rock and you would basically turn it into vapor. And so now what you have is a bunch of little stuff, and anything bigger than, anything smaller than a golf ball, if it were coming into Earth's atmosphere, would simply burn up in the atmosphere before it ever hit the ground. Unless there was something like diamonds in it, where the diamonds simply would not succumb to the heating. But most of this stuff would end up actually in the form of vapor, literally vaporizing this thing, and it would not take very long, maybe a couple weeks, to vaporize a big asteroid. And that's the McCanny method of getting rid of these things. But of course, like I said, the NASA with the trying to send something up and hit an asteroid, well, congratulations for hitting an asteroid. But that's, with the practice that NASA has had over the decades, they really know, and especially these engineers, the unsung heroes of the space age, as I always say, not the scientists who get all the fanfare and the credit, but the engineers that are behind the scenes that make these amazing spacecraft work. To hit an asteroid is quite a feat, because you have it's like a bullet hitting a bullet. Very difficult to do, but they did it, and so my hat's off to those engineers. They're the ones that deserve a lot of praise, not the space scientists who sit in their lofty chairs in universities or in research centers. And, it's really the engineers that make these things work. Okay, but hitting an asteroid, or even the Bruce Willis movie, remember, what is it, Apocalypse something, the movie where Bruce Willis and the gang goes up there, and that really great song by, Stephen, I forget his name, really great music. But the end, the Bruce Willis goes up there and they set nuclear bombs off and blow this thing apart and save the world, that kind of thing. It's not going to work. It's not going to work, because if you blew an asteroid apart, even with a couple nuclear bombs, all you're going to end up with is a number under 100, probably, of big pieces. And now you got a shotgun effect with all this stuff raining in on Earth, and it's really not going to save the day. So what we have to do, and now the benefit of doing what I'm saying, is that you would also be able to, if you did it under controlled circumstances, if you had metal or precious materials in that asteroid, if you had diamonds, if you had, say, metal or gold or tungsten or molybdenum or any other valuable materials, or carbon even, where you could capture the carbon and make it into carbon fiber or other materials, then you would have some very valuable side products that could be garnered from this and brought back to Earth as very valuable, to certainly pay for the mission. And so once again, this is like a parachute, but the parachute is a reflector like Mylar, very lightweight. You know, Mylar is that material like a lot of times if you buy cereal in a box, and it's that very thin, very strong, or a lot of food products are packaged in Mylar. Or chips and things like that. You open up a chip bag, on the outside it has that brilliant printing of the product, etc. But you go inside and it's that reflective material. That's Mylar. And so basically it would be mylar parachute held open by solar wind pressure with the cords going down in a cradle, and then the asteroid sitting in where the, you know, like compared to a parachute, where the guy in the parachute would go, and that's where the asteroid would go, and then the sun's light would focus down on this asteroid and just vaporize it. So your parachute would be maybe, you know, maybe 1,000 feet by 1,000 feet. And it would focus on this region around this asteroid and just vaporize it. So what do you have now? You have just dust. You have vaporized plasma, and that's not going to harm a fleet. So that's the way you get rid of these things. Also in doing a little research on this, there are some craters, large craters known in the world. There's the Chicxulub Yucatan crater. Now, this is the one that they said was the cause of the demise of the dinosaurs, which really did not cause the demise of the dinosaurs. It had a localized effect, and further studies on this showed that the asteroid did not even wipe out the dinosaurs locally, let alone worldwide. There's another crater that they discovered afterwards that was due to oil drilling for fossil fuels. It's called the Nader crater, and it's out farther in the Atlantic Ocean. And then there's a third crater that struck Earth at about that same time back in, they're claiming about 65 million years ago for all of these. It's the Boltish crater that's in Ukraine. And the crater itself is like 24 miles across. I've been to the Winslow, Arizona crater, and they have the actual asteroid there sitting on a pedestal in the museum. But the crater is just, I don't know, it's maybe a mile across. I don't know. I don't know officially how big it is. But it's big enough you wouldn't want to have been around when that thing hit. Probably break your eardrums and ruin your day and maybe kill you and kill a lot of animals for this area around. But now the Ukrainian ejecta from the Ukrainian crater, 24 kilometers wide, they say covered an area of 25,000 square kilometers. So that is a area of about, let's see, let me quick take the square root here. Okay, so that's about 160 kilometers by 160 kilometers, or about 100 miles by 100 mile area. And you think, well, wow, that's a pretty big area. But yeah, compared to the surface of the Earth, that's really not that big. And so these craters are the impact and the ejecta and the effects are absorbed locally. This thing where it's supposedly causes the demise of the dinosaurs worldwide simply is not true. And so people say this, and it's like plate tectonics. It's like so many other things in geology where it looks nice, or subduction, or plate, what do they call it? Plates wandering around the surface of the Earth. It looks nice in a textbook and the pictures and the artist renditions. But when you look at the physics of this, most of that impact is absorbed locally. There's a lot of deformation locally. You have the crater locally. Even these big ones are affecting an area that it's really local. 100 miles by 100 miles is like the size of this might be the quarter of the state of Iowa. You know, that tells you the impact area. Some bigger effect would be like the Yellowstone volcano that went off. There were three of them in the last couple hundred million years. There were three major pyroclastic eruptions of the Yellowstone volcano, and we could potentially be in for another one here if that baby goes off and nobody is allowed to drain the lake there. We could have a third of the United States wiped out in a matter of an afternoon, or wake up in the morning and find out that everything east to Minnesota, south to Missouri, and west to Nevada has been completely wiped out with an explosion from the Yellowstone caldera. And that could happen because what happens is that water falls down onto the magma and it just causes a massive explosion. It's a big steam engine. Okay, so anyway, enough of that, but that is the solution for getting rid of these asteroids. And it's very cheap. It's really, really, really cheap. But NASA didn't buy a parachute for its shuttle and had 14 astronauts die because they forgot to buy a parachute. So, you know, we're talking about the human race here and a lot of devastation locally in some place due to an asteroid potentially hitting Earth. Very easy to get rid of it at the price of a parachute, but don't tell that to NASA. They got to have a $200 million mission to go run a refrigerator-sized piece of junk into the side of an asteroid, which won't do anything. Okay, so on to my next topic here. Green comets, yeah. We got one in the solar system right now. It's a little comet. But why are comets green? And so the end result is that if you look up, which I did, I'm going to do a little research what the standard explanation was. And of course, I already knew what it was. They talk about cyanide. But there's a little problem with that. And that seems to be the standard explanation that is permeated. It's one of those things where astronomers get something and they repeat it. And without ever thinking about it, astronomers, I found, are very, very poor scientists, because they repeat things. They're repeaters. They're textbook repeaters. They're not scientists. And so when this somebody, nobody seems to know where this explanation came from, that cyanide is the cause of green color in the coma around comets. Some of these small comets have very bright green coloration. And so somebody said cyanide. The only problem is cyanide doesn't have any green lines. And so that really couldn't be. And there's not enough cyanide in a comet. It's primarily water. So what's water? It's hydrogen. It's oxygen. And, of course, I'll get a little bit into the structure of comets here. The second explanation that you might find online, and by the way, the structure for cyanide is two carbons and two nitrogens. Together, it's fairly tight, a very fairly strong bond. But the there's literally no green lines that match the comet's color, the green color that you would see in a comet. And by the way, this comet coming in, its designation is C2022E3. That's the name of the comet. And I believe it was found by one of these automated searches. But anyway, it's going to be, they claim, and this is always up for question because comets are unpredictable, but they say it's going to be naked eye visible, which means you're going to be able to go out into the night sky. And from what I'm seeing here, also we're moving into the pattern of new moon, which means that the night sky was going to be pretty dark. We're not going to have lunar light influence. And so, okay, let's take another look then at what other people claim, and then they claim it's the hydrogen line. It's a rare line of C2. The carbon, it's a C2 molecule, basically, and some people claim, well, that would be the cause of the green line, and there is a green line there, but it's a very rare substance. C2 is not something you find in abundance sufficient in a comet so that it puts out enough light that you could literally see it with the naked eye from Earth. And so my explanation is that it's hydrogen. It's the hydrogen green line, the 486 nanometer hydrogen green line. And now that is not a pure green. It's kind of a bluish green. And you'll see that when you see these comets, go look on the line, pick up a, go and do a search for green comet photos, and you'll get hundreds of them. And look at that color, and then go get the green line color spectrum of hydrogen and compare the two. They're exactly the same. You can see that they're the same. And when they do a spectrum, you don't get a perfectly fine line. You get a fading of that off to the red to the red side of the spectrum. And so that is because the comet nucleus is charged and the induced electric dipole redshift is causing it to redshift as the light comes out from the nucleus. So one could perform a very interesting experiment here, very similar to what the Russians did with my theoretical work to prove that the sun fusion is up in its atmosphere, not in its core. The Russians did a very interesting experiment with X-ray detectors, and you could do the same type of experiment. That's explained in my weather book, The Principia Meteorologia, The Physics of Sun-Earth Weather, where I talk about how you prove that the fusion of the sun is up in the atmosphere. Okay, so is it C2, a C2 green line? No. Now, the interesting thing about comets is they do produce nanodiamonds. There is a good amount of carbon, but it's typically in the form of hydrocarbons. It's connected because there's a lot of hydrogen out in outer space, and free carbon is as about as likely as free hydrogen. So they like to combine. So what happens when the hydrogen, which is free in outer space, because it's just like a very nebulous cloud of this in the solar system, but when the hydrogen comes in attracted to the comet nucleus, remember the tail material in the plasma discharge comet model is coming in towards the comet nucleus, that hydrogen combines with carbon, oxygen, sulfur, you name it. That hydrogen is trying to grab onto something and form a very strong bond. And so the other thing that happens is you get H2. Something you don't find in nature on planet Earth, because there's so many things on Earth that hydrogen can bond to, that you simply do not find hydrogen gas. You can separate it easily by a process called electrolysis, and there's other methods, chemical methods, to obtain pure hydrogen. But you don't find it in nature on Earth. You don't find hydrogen free. If you did, it would be a wonderful thing. But hydrogen is connected to carbons, which is oil, in the hydrocarbon chains, everything from thick crude oil down to, you know, the very small hydrogen carbon compounds, volatile chemicals, etc. But hydrogen grabs onto things, but in outer space, you can have H2. Now, what happens with H2? It becomes ionized, which gives you a positively charged hydrogen molecule, H2. And that is where the green line comes from, the hydrogen green line. And now, why is hydrogen in quantity around a comet nucleus? Well, it's been measured. It's been measured as a ionized hydrogen cloud that surrounds a comet nucleus, but the reason it's there is because the comet nucleus is negatively charged. And so the hydrogen is the first layer of the Debye shield. That's an electrical shield that surrounds the comet nucleus. So a Debye shield, let me just explain this kind of in layman's terms. If you took a charged object out into outer space, it would quickly form a space charge sheath around it called a Debye shield. And what happens, and it's in the form of a circle or a sphere, I should say sphere. Looking at it from the side, it would be a circle. And then as you move out away from the charged object, the density of the hydrogen becomes less and less because the charge that is seen is to the inside is shielded, so it eventually fades away, but you get this diffuse, very intense towards the nucleus and then fading as you get out farther, sphere of hydrogen surrounding the comet nucleus. And it's in the Dirty Snowball Comet model, there's no reason for this feature to be there at all. Why would you have ionized hydrogen surrounding an ice ball? It doesn't make any sense, and besides, there isn't an ice ball there in the first place. It's just ridiculous. So at any rate, the green comet coma which is very large, like Comet Holmes back in the day. When was that? Back in the 2000s when Comet Holmes erupted into brightness due to a planetary electrical alignment. It was a diffuse green color, very big. With the naked eye, you could see it almost as large as the full moon. Okay, so getting back to this comet 2022 E3, the green comet that we're expecting to be visible to the naked eye, I did some orbital analysis on this, and the closest approach to Earth will be on February 2nd. So, you know, a couple weeks away yet. But the comet will cross the ecliptic on February 11th. And so that's where we will possibly see some activity, but there are no electrical alignments. Earth has already moved along in its orbit. If Earth were just a couple weeks earlier in its orbit, we would have a nice electrical alignment, and it could actually cause some February hurricanes. But that's not going to happen. There is no good electrical alignment with this comet in anything. So it'll zip through the ecliptic plane of the planets and go away and apparently be back in another 50,000 years is the idea. So anyway, what is the green color and why is it there? I've explained that once again. It's the H2 486 nanometer green line of hydrogen, molecular hydrogen. And now in gaseous form, if you took hydrogen gas and put it into gaseous form in a test tube, like a neon tube, and you ran an electric current through it, which is exactly what's going on out there on that comet, then you would get that green line. You would get a red line, which is the dominant hydrogen line, by the way. And it's interesting, you're not seeing a reddish tint to this at all. You're just seeing that green line. So there's something very specific about the way comets work that give you that green line of hydrogen. And then there's a far blue and a violet line also from hydrogen, but they're very faint. And so ultimately, it's this green line of hydrogen, which is very visible and giving the comet its characteristic green color. But as I said, if you got down to brass tacks and were doing spectroscopy on this comet, what you would find is that if you scanned across the coma of the comet with a spectrometer, you would find that as you were at the very outside edge, you would get a very clean line. You would get a very clean 486 nanometer line. But as you moved in with your spectrometer closer to the nucleus, you would still get that because that's from the outside of this H2 coma, the Debye shield around the charged nucleus. You would get that same reading, but then also as the light coming deeper from the comet is measured, it's going to be redshifted. And it's going to become very faint because it has to shine through all of this outside, the hydrogen cloud on the outside and dust and gases and things like that. But it's going to be a kind of a V-shaped, a sideways V-shaped spectrum that gets redshifted as the light is coming from closer and closer to the comet nucleus in this Debye shield. Okay, so anyway, there we go. That's the green coloration of comets. Now I'm going to switch a little bit to archaeology. And this came about because I was watching a video on, sometimes I just watch these videos, you know, and they're interesting. People have very good YouTube channels. And so this one was about shipwrecks, and this guy's specialty is shipwrecks. And so I was looking at the channel, and there was a shipwreck called the SS Arctic. And it was talking about this tragic where two ships actually collided off of Newfoundland. And one of them was bound towards New York. And the other one was taking fishermen from Newfoundland, the banks, out back to France. And they were just transporting the fishermen back to France where they these fishermen came to the banks up in Nova Scotia to do fishing. So anyway, these two ships in the middle of the night collide, and it might have been even daylight. I can't remember if it was the daylight, but anyway, they were able to see each other. I think it was very foggy, I think was the issue, and they didn't have very much notice. But at any rate, one of the passengers on the SS Arctic, this is back in the 1800s, by the way, was a guy named Catherwood. Catherwood was an artist who drew these amazing plates of the Mayan ruins. They went there in the 1840s. Him and Stevens was basically a businessman from New York, and they got together. And Catherwood had done a lot of art, of architectural art and things like that, but he had also been to the Mideast and Turkey and other places doing artwork of these ancient ruins. So anyway, he was the perfect choice to team up with Stevens and go to, they had an expedition, they went down to the Yucatan. They were inspired by a book authored by, it was available at the time, talking about the discovery of the Mayan ruins. So they went down there and drew them as they found them in the 1800s. This was the first real recognition. And of course, the Spanish had been all through there, basically destroying everything in their path. So there was very little left of the Mayan culture that had already been sequestered by the Spanish. So the first real recognition that there were these major cities there was by John Lloyd Stevens and Frederick Catherwood. I believe that's the correct combination of names there. But when I lived in Mexico, I was amazed by the artwork of Catherwood. And I was just enthralled by them because these big plates, the amazing, amazing detail that you would see, that's just like they came alive. It was like you were actually there. And he had workers in the pictures, you know, starting to take trees and vegetation off of these pyramids. And of course, they had the stelas, a lot of them still in pristine conditions, having been in the jungle for literally thousands, a couple thousand years. And so one thing that's very interesting is at that time, they started putting the dating structure that's still in place today on the Mayas, talking about the Maya being the at their peak of their civilization around 800 A.D., and, of course, they thought that the Mayans had built these cities, which maybe they did. But it's starting to look like maybe they simply occupied an area that had been built previously. But there is an indication that they actually built these pyramids, but built them on top of structures that had already been there. So when I did my surveying, like at Chichen Itza and Uxmal and Tulum, back in the mid-1990s, I literally went down there because I had been to those places as a young man. I had been into those jungle regions exploring, and of course, that's before all of the tourism came about. When we went to Tulum, we were the first people to traverse the old shell road that went from Merida down to Tulum. We were actually the first people to traverse that road when it was opened up one day. We actually had to wait a few days for them to actually open up that road that had been built. And you can still see the old shell road off to the side of the new highway that's there now, connecting Cozumel and the Mayan coast, what they call the Mayan Riviera. Now there's a nice highway that connects Tulum going northwards, but at the time, that was the first time that that had been opened up. But Catherwood had the plates of Tulum, of Chichen Itza, Uxmal, and, you know, just amazing detail. So it was amazing to be part of this archaeological discovery and to understand, this is part of my later understanding, is that the Mayans built these cities on top of old structures, and every 54 years, part of their mythology was that they would rebuild and build a bigger pyramid on top of the old pyramid in thanks that the comet Venus, not the planet Venus, the comet Venus did not come back and ravage Earth. So at any rate, as I was watching this YouTube video on the shipwreck, the guy's talking about the people that died on the shipwreck, and one of them being Catherwood. And I thought, oh my goodness, here's a guy. He was on his way back to New York, going to continue his work, etc., through archaeology, etc., and he has this untimely demise on a shipwreck, just this chance shipwreck out in the middle of the ocean. But interesting how these themes combine, and that just jarred my interest. So what I want you to do, especially young people, is find the plates of Catherwood. It's spelled C-A-T-H-E-R Wood, Catherwood. And look at the plates of these archaeological finds, the way they were in the 1800s. And to me, it was just something amazing, awe-inspiring to think that these guys formed an expedition in the 1840s, had to go down there by boat, land there, form an expedition, find guides to take them inland, because these places, Tulum is right on the ocean, and apparently it was a fairly active port city of the Maya. In fact, one of the structures right on the coastline is clearly a lighthouse, where the ships would come in and have to cut through the reef, which was out beyond Tulum. And when I was there, we would swim out daily to the reef and dive for conch and fish, and that's what we were living on when we were staying there, fish and conch and rice and coconuts, not a lot of coconuts. There was a coconut farm there that stretched for miles, and so we could have all the coconuts you wanted in coconut water. Very, very good for you, very healthy environment. And then that's also where I was able to meet the Lacandon Indians, who still were there. They were had a village off of Tulum. And so one day I took off walking to find this village. And I talk about that in my lectures, my radio show last year. I went into detail on that, so I'm not going to repeat it here. But it jogged my memory of being in Mexico during those years, going back later in the 1990s to actually survey on the ground, finding the true north, south, east, and west directions of those cities, and then realizing that they were set on the old gridwork, and then talking about the old North Pole being in what is now Hudson Bay. Something that's being studied by other people at this time. So right now I'm going to do a little segue. I'm going to talk about my new book, The Real History of Man and Earth, Myths, Magic, and Mayhem. And this book is now available on my webpage. I'm getting very good reviews. People are talking about this. And it's the 14th book in the series of my books. And I'm calling it a supplement to my original book, Planet X, Comets, and Earth Changes, that was released in about the year 2000. And so what's happening here is I'm developing a little bit of an encyclopedia of my work, and then I have the education package. So right now we're working on bundling all of this together. But I encourage you to get this new book. It's just released. It's $19.95. Or if you buy any other products on the webpage, either the book packages or the water filters or the grow towers or any other products that are offered on the webpages, you will get the book for free. So just make note of that. And so if you're looking for water filter products and need replacements for your gravity water filter. That's one of our biggest selling items, or a whole house water filter, and or a sink filter, or a filter for the office, or the education packages that I sell online. You buy any of those and you get the new book free. But one of my biggest lifelong interests has been in archaeology. It's just a remarkable thing to be digging up these past civilizations and, you know, looking at the ruins and wondering what were these people like, or what did their language sound like, and what did, you know, what were their customs, what were, you know, what were their goals, what were their, you know, what was their religion, what was their science like. And unfortunately, a lot of the Mayans and Aztec science had been destroyed, completely destroyed by the Spanish. One of the great human crimes of all of history is what the Spanish did to those people, killing them off, bringing their diseases, and then stealing everything, all of these amazing artifacts made out of gold. Imagine that there would be just unbelievable, like gigafactory-sized museums filled with all of these artifacts that they made out of gold and other pottery and stone carvings and stelas. And all of this was destroyed by the Spanish. Only a very small percentage of it remained. In fact, for example, in Peru, they estimate that about only 10 to 20% of the structures of the Incas remain, where the Spanish just came in and literally destroyed everything, took everything, took it apart, destroyed it, cut up the old temples or whatever of the Incas, made them into cathedrals, and literally just took all the gold, literally removed everything that was gold, which was fabulous amounts of gold, boiled it down into what they called pieces of eight. Pieces of eight were coins, or doubloons, which is another name. I think that was the French name, but pieces of eight were a coin, and what they had on each side was a cross representing Christ. And on both sides, there was a cross, so it divided the coin into four on one side and four on the other. So they were called pieces of eight, literally the number eight. And so pieces of eight, and they boiled all of these amazing artifacts down into basically bullion of some form or bars, and they used it as the ballast of ships. And these were ships that were hundreds of feet long, taking a tremendous amount of ballast, and they were filled with gold. That's how much gold there was. In fact, there were hundreds of these ships going between the New World and Spain and England and the Netherlands, etc., but mainly the Spanish were the biggest booty robbers of all this booty in the New World, just absolutely amazing amounts of gold. And just to give you an idea, that there are 25 ships off the coast of the Dominican Republic in what is known as the Mona Channel. It flows from the Caribbean out into the Atlantic Ocean. There's a tremendous tide there, about a 7-mile-an-hour tide. But it's the biggest passage in the between the Caribbean islands and the deepest. So that's where the big Spanish galleons used to go. And they would be blown off course. And there were 25 of them that sunk off of the eastern coast of the Dominican Republic. And they're still there. They know the bill of lading, what was on those ships. And they're all packed with gold. And it's there are other ships around the Caribbean. Some of them were unknown, and you may have seen some TV specials dealing with these treasure hunters who are out there looking for a specific ship. And some of them they found. They literally found the entire load of gold from these ships, and were able to recover that. But that's just one of hundreds of ships. And like I say, just off the coast of the Dominican Republic, there are no less than 25 major ships laden with gold that are down there, and it's well guarded by the Dominican Republic. It's not an area. These are typically in very rough water, in an area that you really just you cannot dive, or it's very difficult to get even a boat into the area. And but just imagine that those are the 25 ships that didn't make it, and vast amounts of gold, enough to ballast these amazingly big Spanish galleon ships. And if you're familiar with ballast on sailboats, it takes a lot of ballast, a lot of metal to ballast these ships. And so imagine that it was pure gold in the ballast of these ships going back to Spain. Unbelievable amounts of wealth. And by the way, that's where the Vatican got its start, the Vatican Worldwide Bank that is in existence today and garnishes its power from that gold that was stole from the Aztecs and the Incas, not so much from the Mayas. The Mayas did not have tremendous amounts of gold like the Incas and the Aztecs, but they took it all. I was in Cusco in Peru, and there's a wall there that is probably many, many meters thick, maybe 3, maybe 5 meters thick. And it's about maybe 3 meters high. And it's the entire top of this wall went in completely around the royal city of Cusco when the Inca royalty lived there. That's where the Inca royalty were when the Spanish arrived. And eventually, of course, the Spanish killed off the Incas. They fled into the wilderness, taking some of their artifacts with them. But, of course, they couldn't take all of this gold, and the Spanish literally took all of that gold off of this wall. It was a cap that was many meters high and maybe 4 meters wide that ran completely around this city, solid gold cap to that wall, and the Spanish took it all. Unbelievable, just theft of these amazing artifacts that were put there. And, you know, so the Incas had built this up over literally hundreds, possibly thousands of years since the last major catastrophe, and that was around 1500 BC. And the once again, we see the Inca structures that simply cannot be duplicated with the best modern equipment. There's no way we could redo or rebuild or reconstruct what was there, or the Egyptian pyramids, or, you know, so there were, one thing that's very good that's going on today is the wall is coming down on traditional archaeology, that the Egyptian pharaohs did not build the pyramids. There were some very advanced races prior to that simply are gone. We don't have any record of them, and that is because of the Great Flood, which just literally washed the earth clean, and then the Moses event, where there were Quetzalcoatl is the representation of the Mayas, the comet, the great comet Venus, as they called it, or Quetzalcoatl, and was known to carry the ocean on his back, in other words, tidal waves or tsunamis, and when those big ocean waves came in, it just washed everything clean, just completely took whatever was there and washed it back out into the ocean. Or a seashell, that's why we see seashells very high up in the mountains, just laying there. You go up into the very highest regions of the mountains in the Andes, and you find seashells from the ocean. And that's because that's how big these ocean waves were. And when that water washed back out, it just took everything with it. There's a city along the Peruvian coast that it's estimated there were 40 million people living there. And that's what they're realizing also about the Mayan cities of Chichen Itza and Palenque and Uxmal and Tikal, Copan. All of these cities had millions of people. They were the size of New York City. And when I lived there, the estimate was that those cities maybe had maximum maybe 30,000, 40,000 people there. That's what the archaeologists thought. And now, due to aerial surveys where they can see what's underground, they realize that these are very large cities, sprawling cities where they had a large-scale agriculture and water systems, aqueduct systems, etc., for the agriculture, and the whole world was highly populated at one time. But everything is gone. And the reason it's gone, as I said, is because it just got washed back out into the ocean. All the people, all the stuff, the potsherds, the everything. The water just came in and massive waves just washed it away. So you had the Noah's Great Flood, and then you had the Venus event, where you had giant, huge tsunamis washing everything clean. And so we don't have really much record of these people or how they built these structures, or what their building techniques were, etc. Anyway, very interesting. So remember, in the next couple of weeks, look up in the night sky and you should be able to see this green comet. You might be able to, if your local newspaper has information or online, I'm sure there are star charts that you can find online to tell you exactly where to look. But or you could look with binoculars or low-powered telescopes. But just you should be able to see it with the naked eye. But remember that the what you're looking at, that green color, is due to the hydrogen-green line, as I talked about, in that hydrogen is there in abundance, enough for you to see from Earth, because of the Debye shielding around the charged comet nucleus. So those hydrogen structures were directly measured by comet probes. Okay, so at any rate, got about a minute left to go here. Remember, go to my webpages, jmccsci.com. You can, from there, you can get to the water filter page. You can read about the wind, JMCC wing generator, the grow towers, amazing products. So you can grow food, organic, high quality food, true organic, in your own house or out on the deck, or even start a commercial venture. And then the new book is there, The Real History of Man and Earth, Myths, Magic, and Mayhem book is there. And, I suggest you read that to understand really what's going on in the world. It's a very important, timely book dealing with the various things going on in the world of archaeology and a lot of exposure of misinformation. Once again, this is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.